In June of 1971, President Richard Nixon declared a war on drugs. The year before, a list of harsh penalties was created for the possession of marijuana, heroin, and LSD. These drugs became highly illegal, with no distinction between them, despite huge differences in their effects. President Reagan doubled down, and over the course of the next 20 years, mass incarceration increased exponentially. In 1986, the Anti-Drug Abuse Act created mandatory minimum sentences for drug possession and use. And between the 80s and 90s, the number of people in prison for nonviolent drug offenses grew from 50,000 to over 400,000. The war on drugs locked up millions of people, more than tripling the number of Americans in prison. At the same time, violent crime and homicide continued to increase, a trend that had started in the 1960s and culminated with a peak in the late 80s and early 90s. The question of what causes violent crime has always been highly contested. In our third episode of this season, we looked at its correlation with both poverty and wealth inequality. But theories have explored a wide range of factors, from population aging and population density in urban areas, to unemployment, to alcohol consumption, to policing, to people's access to mental health resources, to lead exposure, and to people's access to abortion. One of the main motivations of the war on drugs was to address the perceived connection between drugs and gun violence. This connection is really hard to study in a comprehensive way, but there's no doubt that the intersection of violence and the drug economy has been a major narrative for American media and policymakers. Since 2020, Philadelphia has had a level of gun violence we haven't seen since the crack cocaine epidemic of the early 90s. And while the drug economy is not responsible for all of this violence, some of it is certainly connected to the current day opioid crisis that people in Philly and across the nation are facing today. Michelle Alexander's 2010 bestseller, The New Jim Crow, frames the war on drugs as a racial justice issue. Because even though people across race and ethnicity report similar rates of drug use, it is Black and Latinx people who are much more likely to be stopped, searched, arrested, and convicted for drug crimes. If you drive through parts of North Philly, you can see the deindustrialization process laid bare in the shells of abandoned factories. Plants closing in urban areas meant that people who had solid middle-class jobs were suddenly poor. And in the face of this, some of these people turned to drugs, either as drug sellers or drug users. The neighborhood of Kensington is now known as the heroin capital of the world, and it faces some of the highest rates of drug trafficking and gun violence in the city. I'm Chris Henderson of Amistad Law Project, and this is Move It Forward, a podcast about violence in America, about where we are and where we've been. From the personal to the political, we're exploring the impact on both those who have caused harm and those who have been harmed, here in our city of Philadelphia. What have we done to address murders and shootings, and what actually reduces violence? In this episode, we're exploring the drug economy in Philly and in other cities in the U.S. We'll unpack how the drug economy works, both in the present day and in a historical context, as we dig deeper into its connection with violence. We'll hear from familiar voices from past episodes, as well as some new ones, including author and researcher Philippe Bourgois, and some folks we met walking around Kensington, asking the questions you'll hear on the show today. You mentioned 1983 and 2003 as the sort of bounds of this war. What happened in each of those years to create those limits?
1983 was the kind of onset of the crack cocaine war in the neighborhood. And we watched crack roll through our neighborhood like Hurricane Katrina, devastating the community, uprooting families, I mean, destroying relationships. Like, man, it decimated families and communities. In the late 70s, early 80s, there was a huge kind of migration of major corporations transitioning out of the country. And so in Watts and in South LA, we had the GM plant, we had the Firestone plant. A lot of people worked at those factories. And so when those plants packed up and moved overseas, a lot of people lost their job. You know, people always dibbled and dabbled in hustling, selling a little weed, you know, little pills and stuff on the side in order to make ends meet. And also it was a way of self-medicating and dealing with the trauma of being in a country where you're not seen as human. And so the flight of the jobs really left people in a hard place. And so people start utilizing more drugs in order to deal with the trauma and the stress. And then that whole market expanded during the whole Iran-Contra war and Reagan and all of those folks over there bringing cocaine by the truckloads into the U.S. as the largest drug market in the world, right? And those drugs were dumped right into our community. One of my good friends has a film right now on Netflix called Cracking the System. Him and my brother-in-law, Cornell Ward, grew up together. They were selling drugs for the CIA and didn't know it. Drugs flooded the street. And so people start making ridiculous amounts of money. And it started creating conflict in terms of territory of where people were making money.
In the 20th century, manufacturing was one of the few industries that offered people of color and second-generation immigrants the opportunity for a stable career. But as the U.S. began to restructure into a service economy in the 1950s, hundreds of thousands of these jobs were shipped overseas. Today, Akilah Shirelles is the executive director of the NORC Community Street Team, a community-based violence reduction organization. But in L.A. in the 80s, he saw the decades-long trend of deindustrialization. People had begun to really feel the result of mass unemployment, salary cuts, and the weakening of unions. Many turned to underground economies, especially men of color, who are arguably the least accepted in the formal working world. Selling drugs led these men to become targets for mass incarceration and for shootings in their neighborhoods, leaving the next generations without fathers and brothers, and even fewer resources and support.
Like I told y'all before, my mom got 12 kids, so like, that's a lot of mouths to feed. There's certain times when you had like no food and stuff like that. And my dad was locked up since I was 4, so I just didn't like seeing my mom trying to work jobs and do this and do this. So that's where I had to step up at and like help her out in the house and stuff like that. You asked me about growing up fast. Yeah, I had to grow up fast. Not just me. I got 2 brothers that's older than me, and my brother, he got locked up for like caseworking. When you sell drugs on a block, it's different people. You got like corner boys, you got like the big boss that like provides everything. The caseworker is the person that holds the drugs because you don't want everybody to get locked up for the drugs if the cops come. So if this corner boy need more drugs, the caseworker gives him more drugs. At the end of the day, all the money is turned over to the caseworker, and then the caseworker turns the money over to the boss. So my brother was a caseworker, and unfortunately, he got locked up. That was my oldest brother. And then my second oldest brother, he was locked up because he was robbing banks. So that just left me with my mom and all my younger siblings, and she was just trying to take care of all of us. So like, I tried to step up and help her like in any way possible that I could. I was helping my mom put food in the house and helping my siblings get like school clothes and like school sneakers, but I was just a kid. My brother had a scholarship to the University of Southern California, full ride. He played football. He had one to Berkeley and he had one for USC. But right before he was supposed to leave, he got shot in his chest. USC said he could still come though. They said, we're gonna still let you like come on an academic scholarship. He told my mom that he didn't want to go because we didn't have enough money to support him all the way in California. And I just honestly think that he lost faith. He thought he was going to be like a real football star, but after he got shot in his chest, he felt like there was nothing else but to do but to just keep selling drugs.
Most people understand now that the American dream has failed, that we can't just work hard, make money, and live comfortably. Many of us have watched people we know and love work themselves to death and never make it out of the gutter. Will saw his family turn to the drug economy, accepting the risk of arrest and incarceration. Will is an organizer at the Youth Art and Self-Empowerment Project, and he spoke about what this was like for him. After the Civil War, the Black Codes and Jim Crow laws severely limited the types of jobs Black and brown people could get. Farming and selling cash crops like tobacco, along with other addictive substances like alcohol, marijuana, and cocaine, were some of the only ways they could make money. It's shameful yet unsurprising to see Black and brown men limited to the same sectors of the economy now, almost 200 years later. Why do you think people go into the drug economy? Why do you think people start selling?
If you don't got nobody, from the time you wake up, from the time you go sleep being there, and you hungry, your light's going off, you ain't in no good program, you ain't DHS. Like, you go to school, and everybody got designer on or a name brand, and you got on bum clothes, you gonna want to do something to get you there. You finding like, oh, damn, he's selling that, I'm gonna sell that too. That's just how it go.
I really want to say everybody get their money out of these selling drugs and all that. So, because I don't like seeing it now because it escalates to like bigger problems than what it should be. Because like if somebody's giving you drugs, they might give you the wrong stuff. People be putting stuff in your stuff. So it's easier and quicker money. Like if you get a job, you're going to have to work throughout them whole 7 days. And then you get paid next week or something like that. On the block, you get paid like this. And that's like more money coming in, more money coming in, more money coming in. But a job, you got to get that check, save it, get that check, save it, get that check, save it. And don't nobody want to do that. Everybody want to get that money fast. And I understand where people come from, but it's just like, I don't want to see people see themselves doing that for their whole entire lives. Like, when y'all get your money off the block and stuff, like y'all get however much money y'all want, what is your next step? Where y'all gonna go from the block from here? Because half of these people out here got kids, they got families. Nowadays, people getting shot just for standing on the corner. I feel like they need to find something else other than selling drugs to get their money.
Yane knows that even when dealing drugs can offer much more than a minimum wage job, it often doesn't get people anywhere, especially when it's so intertwined with gun violence, addiction, and mass incarceration. Yeah Philly encourages young people like her and Kenzie, who spoke before, to ask these bigger questions of what feeds the cycle and how to find a different path. Yeah owns a house in West Philly where young people can hang out, record music, and play games, where they can get help on their homework, money to pay bills, and conflict mediation training. Growing up in Philly in the 80s, Photo didn't have this sort of support. In a sense, he was raised to be a part of the game and fed through the pipeline from a poor neighborhood into prison for a life sentence. In episode 3, he spoke about the many reasons why he and the people around him were in the drug game, from economic desperation to being raised in the culture to fighting for a semblance of respect in a world where it's hard to find any. In many ways, street dealing and addiction have become part of the norm in poor neighborhoods. And this isn't because the people there are immoral, but because it's so hard to imagine what it would take to get out of poverty, or what it would take to make their hoods a place where kids could actually play in the street, where everyone could have what they need. And in situations like this, violence becomes a currency.
The more I got involved, the more I know I can, you know, get the things I wanted to get. You go from lookout to getting a shift where you're selling the bags of weed yourself. They give you a bundle of weed is like 10 dime bags, which is $100. Out of the $100, you turn in 80 and keep 20. At one point, it got in my mind, like, I'm out here risking my life and everything for, like I was saying, for $20 while I'm giving this man $80. So at a point, I felt like, why am I making him all this money and I'm the one taking all the risk? So it went from me being a lookout to being a hustler to me being a stick-up kid. I would sit and watch the drug dealers on the block, certain blocks, and I would see where they would put their stash at. I would see when they shift end. And then when they was done with their shift and they got all their money together, I would go and rob them for everything they had. Because it's like, why would I risk hustling if I could just take it from him? And I know for sure he not going to call the cops on me because what he going to tell them, I took his drugs from him? Back in our days when I was out there, dudes who were getting into stuff like that, they came from like Puerto Rico. We call them hibaros. And what that means is they straight from the island. They have no sense. They don't know English or nothing. They would get called from Puerto Rico to Philly, do the dirt for one of the big-time drug dealers, and then go right back to Puerto Rico and disappear again. They was basically hired hitmen. And it just changed now to these young boys who have no guidance, no one to guide these young kids, and all they see is the street life. What do you think they want? They want the money. They want the respect. They want the reputation. So they're going to get it by any means necessary.
In the early 1900s, after invading and seizing control of Puerto Rico, the U.S. forced hundreds of thousands of farmers off their land and into wage labor on massive sugar plantations. After World War II, over 1.5 million people fled from Puerto Rico to the United States in search of a better life, but they arrived as many jobs were being shipped overseas. Thousands moved to Philly during that time, and today the city has the second largest Puerto Rican population in the country. Many moved to the neighborhood of Kensington. Located along the Delaware River and train lines, the area was a major industrial site. But by the end of the Korean War, a majority of those jobs disappeared.
And so Puerto Ricans came in at that worst time possible. And the whites who had traditionally worked in those neighborhoods had started leaving because the factories were closing down or they were only operating 2 or 3 days a week. The jobs were getting very insecure. They weren't able to compete with basically globalization, with the factory owners becoming multinational corporations and going to other countries or other parts of the United States where people weren't unionized and where wages are lower and one doesn't have a right to complain and demand an 8-hour working day with decent conditions. So the whites were starting to basically just leave those neighborhoods, move to other states, to other sectors of the economy. And Puerto Ricans came in and initially accepted those jobs, even if it was just 2 days a week and it was not unionized, because it was better than starving in Puerto Rico.
Between 2010 and 2017, the number of Puerto Ricans in Philly grew by 60%, as thousands tried to escape the island's economic crisis and then the destruction caused by Hurricane Maria. Puerto Ricans have faced huge barriers to education, employment, and state benefits, leaving them with few options other than the drug trade. Philippe Bourgois has written extensively on the connection between black markets and violence. He's an anthropologist who directs the Center for Social Medicine at UCLA. He has spent many years of his life living in areas where drug economies have flourished, including Kensington. Bourgois has written a number of books that have helped us to better understand the economic and political factors that shaped the experiences of people like Photo and Aquila, and the ways in which the history of the 80s and 90s is repeating itself today. As Ghani was a young boy, feeling the effects of crack cocaine coming into Crown Heights, something you can hear more about in episode 3, Philippe Bourgois was working as a grad student.
I got an apartment in East Harlem on 115th Street, and the word crack didn't exist in March, and by the fall of 85, everyone was talking about it, and a couple of my neighbors were selling it and using it, and it was sweeping basically mostly youth off their feet, but also older people, and was taking people by surprise. Also, the prices of cocaine had just dropped. They had dropped about 2, 3, 4 years earlier. So there had been a shift already going on in terms of global supplies coming in. All of a sudden, you had this extraordinarily high quality powder cocaine that just dropped. It felt like tenfold in price at the street level. And it was interesting because it hit the inner city much, much faster than it hit wealthy neighborhoods, because I had access to seeing sort of drug use in both environments. Being a graduate student, you see it among university kids. And the prices were 10 times different at that time. It was hard to believe, actually.
And when you say there was like a difference in the prices, you're saying the drugs were cheaper in inner city areas?
Yeah, they were cheaper and stronger. It was actually remarkable. It wasn't ambiguous. And so the Italian mafia was still in existence at that time, but it was being pushed out by the new drug organizations that were replacing it. Primarily, actually, at the wholesale level, it was Dominican organizations that were at that time in New York City controlling the distribution of both heroin and cocaine. But the street sellers themselves were usually Puerto Rican and African American, and sometimes a white addict. So it was an interesting racialized transformation in control of drug markets. And that's what created the tragic violence that came with crack. Because whenever there's a restructuring of traditional supplies of drugs, and all of a sudden prices change, and new groups of upwardly mobile drug sellers are attempting to enter into the market, it leads to competition. And when things are illegal, you can't take it to a judge. I mean, that's the purpose, you know, in some sense of courts, so that you don't have to shoot and murder and kill and shout at and beat people up. You have a court of law that you know will more or less guarantee your rights and enforce contracts. That's obviously not available for drugs. That's the problem with the illegality of drugs. So that foments violence. And it's so much money that often a person that starts out not wanting to be violent ends up having to be violent. What's very strange about violence is that it starts to become your common sense and confuse you. So when you have a material force like an illegal drug market and racism, in the case of the policing system and the legal system in the United States, which treats people differently by the color of their skin, the U.S. is so racist that it manages to mistreat people just for having a different ethnic identity. It's kind of amazing. Just for having a different accent in court and just for not wearing the right clothes that please a judge. So that setup confines people to certain sectors of the economy. And then when those sectors are illegal, as in the case of drugs, people then become violent to enforce contracts, to make sure they get paid fairly or abusively in the case of people that have monopolies. And then people start getting greedy and trying to control the drug corner, killing them, beating them up when they sell on their turf. And then you get people ripping off their customers, and then the customers shoot them and so forth.
In the 70s and 80s, cocaine trafficking from South America dramatically increased. The U.S. government had focused on regulating marijuana and heroin by imprisoning leaders of drug networks and heavily policing supply routes. Many drug importers began to traffic cocaine instead, because it is easier to transport, and on a local level, dealers began to mix the drug with baking soda to make crack. Doing this made their supplies last longer and provided people with a product that made the effects of cocaine hit faster, harder, and shorter, which kept people craving more. Between 1982 and 1985, 1.6 million more people began to use cocaine. In the mid-90s, the legal prescription of opioids began when the FDA approved OxyContin for pain management. Pharmaceutical companies began to produce a variety of opioids that they claimed were less addictive than other similar drugs, but many more people became dependent. When people can no longer get these prescriptions, they often turn to heroin, which has a similar high. In Philly's neighborhood of Kensington, drug trafficking is almost a $1 billion industry, and law enforcement has found people selling drugs on more than 80 different blocks in the area. Some blocks are estimated to make up to $60,000 per day, and in the heart of the neighborhood, the rate of shootings is 11 times higher than anywhere else in the city. In 2007, Bourgois rented an apartment in Kensington with a few other researchers. For 6 years, they studied how deindustrialization and disinvestment had left the neighborhood vulnerable to the narcotics trade and the violence that comes with it.
You don't see rich people selling drugs on street corners. You only sell drugs on street corners when you're desperate, basically, and when you don't have other opportunities. As soon as you get a decent alternative opportunity, you do go into that. And that's what needs to be understood.
That violence and everything that comes because of drugs, the majority of the time they find you for the corners. That corner over there, I'll be there. They came with a gun. Everybody, give me your shit. Everybody. If the drug wasn't out here, it won't be too much violence. Let me tell you, don't think that these people that sell drugs like it. The majority of them, they don't like it. They saying that they risking their life. They making money for the rich people. Like the white man, like I would say. Making the money for the white man, you get locked up, you're using drugs, you don't have money, now they're gonna bail you out? No.
Why do you think there is violence in this neighborhood?
Because it's high poverty. People say that money is the root of all evil, but in reality, poverty is. Poverty is the root of all evil. When there's money, people are more relaxed. So you go to a suburban area where they're making almost $100,000, six-figure, seven-figure a year, when in this neighborhood, they're barely making five figures, some not even four. There are people who make less than $10,000 a year. So with that being said, there's going to be a high crime rate in a impoverished neighborhood because there's lack of resources, and people have to turn to crime in order to get what they need to nourish themselves.
Those were the voices of two people who shared interviews with us on the streets of Kensington, Ada and Rashid Nicholson, also known as Hotshot Shakur. While researching for this episode, our show's producer Kyla and I went there to talk to people about their experiences. As we walked around the neighborhood, we saw people so inebriated that they could barely stand, people passed out on the street, and many actively using drugs. Even though people don't like seeing open drug use, it's often safer for people to use on the street. There are people around who can help them if they overdose, and there's a definite community among those who camp out in this area.
How long have you lived here?
Well, I currently don't live in the neighborhood, but I've been down here in the area since like 2007.
How have things changed since you've been here?
Well, it changed drastically. Like in 07, it was more calmer. It wasn't this many drug users in the neighborhood. You can honestly just walk around and be outside. The drug trafficking was segregated to like specific blocks. So it changed drastically in terms of the condition of the neighborhood.
So now you're saying like there's drug users all over the neighborhood?
It's drug users everywhere. They everywhere. I mean, when I go out of town and people ask me about it, I compare this to like a mini Amsterdam, or it's like New York in the 80s. You feel what I'm saying?
Why do you think folks start using drugs?
Depression, lack of income. This is a low income neighborhood. It causes stress, and the stress causes people to go do things that will help alleviate the stress. And drugs is one of the options. You feel what I'm saying? You know, there's not too many recreational centers. They shut down the Salvation Army, so they're not giving away food no more. People use drugs to deal with their depression and anxiety.
Listen, I'm gonna tell you a little bit of a story about me. I never used drugs. When my son hanged himself, I started with crack. I was a very heavy smoke cracker. I needed my crack, not no more. And I'm gonna tell you why. One day I stood with my grandson and I smelled that odor. And I said, I fought Jeremy, what's that stupid odor? He said, Grandma, please, this is K2. And I'm older than him. I didn't know nothing about K2. I didn't never know that. And I said, damn, it smells so awful. Look how it got you nice and mellow. To today, I don't smoke crack. I didn't believe that one drug take the other. But now I believe it. But the K2 is fucking me up. I wake up sick. Nausea, a very hard stomach ache. But to me, I'm glad I tasted K2 because I don't smoke crack. And K2 is $2 and crack is $5. And K2 lasts you a longer than the crack. The crack lasts you a few minutes. And then you want more, I want more. That was tearing me apart.
Do you know young guys who sell drugs?
A whole bunch. In front of my stuff, there's young kids that sell drugs.
Why do you think they get into it?
Because of the job recommend. And then they come out of prison, this virus, what can they do? My son, he said, Mommy, I want to work. I don't want to be in the street making money like that. And I said, Papi, there's a lot of opportunity. Well, he said, Mommy, not for a little bit of money. I want to make money so I won't have to come back to the streets. Because they don't have enough and they work so much for that little bit. I stopped selling drugs because I said, damn, I get locked up, ain't no more exercise. They'll cut it off. And I tried since 1998, I tried for my disability. And they denied it. They said, if you stop doing drugs, you'll be able to work. So I let it alone. I kept on selling drugs. That's how I was making my living. Once I stopped, they gave me my SSI. I said, Mommy, no more, Mommy. I was doing it because I wasn't no welfare. That was when they cut the 102 for everybody, that I just only stayed with the food stamp, because that's a mistake when the government cut that 102. How many people then went out there stealing and all that? Huh?
Philippe Bourgois has focused his research on inner city segregation and the ways in which poor people and people of color have been left in neighborhoods with few services or only hostile ones like policing and hyper-incarceration. Back in the mid-80s and early 90s, the decline of manufacturing and the growth of the service, finance, and real estate industries came with a recession. Wealth inequality and unemployment increased, along with the cost of living, as minimum wage and welfare stagnated. Excluded from the job market, more and more people got discouraged and stopped looking for conventional work. And like Ada described, many struggle to navigate the systems of welfare and social security.
people enter the labor force of the drug market on some level before they have common sense. They often enter it in their teenage years. Teenagers are teenagers, you know. Their brains aren't fully developed, they're immature, and when they don't have an opportunity for an after-school job or a summer job, they go to wherever they can get some money and some status to, you know, buy a new pair of sneakers, buy food, and so forth. So the drug economy itself gets normalized. And once you've seen how effective violence is, and necessary, tragically, violence is, you start getting confused in your interpersonal relations. When you don't get something you want in a personal relationship, in a romantic relationship, you start to want to solve that problem violently. That doesn't happen to everyone, but it creates a common sense, tragically, of violence that is toxic for interpersonal relations.
There's crime on all levels. It's just the magnitude of that crime differs. Here, there's high violent crimes, while in a suburban area, there's less violence and more self-crime where people are victimized from drug use, rape. Down here, there's a lot of guns. Over there, everybody's licensed to have a gun. Everybody know each other, so nobody got to kill. Down here, you arrested by the time you 18. Wherever there's poverty, high violence lives because of depression and trauma. And people who have traumatic lifestyles make traumatic decisions. The person who's never experienced trauma as a child is less likely to commit an act of murder. Lack of mother, lack of father, lack of resources. They went nights without gas, without water. They have suppressed anger. They have suppressed issues that they never dealt with. They come to the conclusion that no one cares about them, no one loves them. And that creates their neurological thought pattern that causes violence.
When there are fewer drugs on the streets, do you think that helps?
No, because there will never be fewer drugs on the streets. It's impossible. History has already proven it. Drug use is an ongoing thing. People have been using drugs in the 80s, the 70s, the 60s, the 50s. So there will never be no drugs because it's part of the economical structure.
We already destroyed because the drugs is already here. Ain't no stopping. It's a damn deal. They should have never brought it out here to begin with. Who are they killing? They're not killing them. They're killing us and young kids. I hope my kids, when they grow up, they don't. Because it wasn't like this. It wasn't nada like this. We didn't live where there was no drugs. We never knew what was drugs. If I had $1 million, I would buy me a castle like that. My big pots of soup, food, women's only. I will keep them in my place, feed them. But don't do drugs. You could come, but don't do drugs in my building. I would say that's the only thing I really, really, really want is stop that drug shit.
What do you think about the cops? You think they're helping?
The cops, they just sit there. Unless they take a knife or a gun. Otherwise, they leave you. Kill yourself. They do not care. I see it every day. Every day. Especially with the cops that be here. They don't do nothing. It's not never going to stop. Because right now, we showing a show to them. That's their job. They sit here. They're already working because they're seeing what they want to see.
These folks we interviewed on the street paint a clear picture of a community of people who use drugs, being despised by the public, and desperately needing resources but receiving none.
The violence with drugs is a product of how hostile and brutal the state is in repressing it. That said, it's not good to get lots of drugs out there. So I'm not like a pro-drug person, but I'm an anti-criminalization person. And that's the balance that needs to happen. And we've had extraordinary historical experiments with that in the United States, right, with prohibition, alcohol, and with changes in drug laws. And right now, there are extraordinary experiments all across the world with countries with different policies towards the exact same drugs. And you can see very clearly that the criminalization of it does decrease how much drugs reach the entire population. But with criminalization of drugs, especially in countries that are big, whose borders are impossible to police and stop. The result is they get concentrated very, very, very intensely in specific types of neighborhoods that devastate a lot of the people living in those neighborhoods, because basically the drugs end up getting dumped there, both purposefully, but also because of the structure of forces that channel drugs to the areas where the state doesn't function or where the state is so hostile that it becomes corrupt and starts selling the drugs as well. And that was the situation in East Harlem. You had a demoralized police force, a racist police force, you know, a mostly white police force that hated the population that it was policing. And some of them were completely corrupt and some of them were just completely brutal. And, you know, obviously there were probably a few that were decent. I didn't happen to meet them, but that's the nature of police forces in the United States, that you have tremendous amounts of petty corruption that from the street is major corruption, because basically they're holding up legally the drug corners and then reselling it to their favorite seller or whatever seller their contact is, and then shuffling the sellers around de facto. And because of how police forces are unaccountable for the most part in the United States, that can go on for years and years. There's extraordinarily well-documented stories of that in New York and in Baltimore and Philadelphia over and over ad nauseum.
Taxpayers spend about $70 billion each year on corrections and incarceration. As we walked around Kensington, we were surprised to see a number of cops seeming to ignore a lot of what was happening. The scale of drug dealing in Kensington makes it clear that law enforcement can't save us from this problem. With city and state support, the Philly police have focused more recently on stopping shootings, gun possession, and conducting major drug busts. But even as heroin networks are dismantled, there are always more dealers who can start selling and fighting over newly opened blocks. With this cycle repeating itself for decades, we're still left with the question of what should be done, what can be done.
And so I've seen the war on drugs take a form that I think caused far more destruction than it did public safety. It would seem like we were never winning. It was never ending. We were spending a lot of money. A lot of people were jailed for very lengthy periods of time, leaving children, leaving households destitute with no income. No one calculates those casualties. And it was a full speed ahead, arrest people with addiction issues and jail them for long periods of time. That cost us a lot of money so that we weren't investing in those things that could really, truly help kids, you know, like parks, recs, social activities, raising minimum wage so mothers don't have to work several jobs, making education affordable so people can earn a decent living. But instead, we put that all in the war on drugs and locking folks up and giving police nice gadgets to do so. We shifted our funding paradigm to only value one aspect of safety versus others. Because when I say public safety, policing is only a piece of that pie. The rest of that pie, which is stability, you know, access to healthcare, access to food that keeps you healthy in your mind, access to education, all of that is public safety too. And how much have we disinvested from those things? So I saw the war on crime, the way it looked in the system was that you had an overburdened system, overburdened public defenders that represented about 70 to 80% of the people that were coming in that could not keep up with the constitutional requirements to make sure that people were being fairly processed. So I think policing with drugs is the same in terms of dealing and selling low level to, you know, large level. They may have changed in the way they deal with users, the people who are addicted to these drugs. And that change hasn't been widespread. It's been really in a particular focus, which is opioids. But I think there's going to be a level of violence associated with drug dealing. I just do. And I know that people don't like to say that. But yeah, because I know that there's a lot of low-level drug dealers that are survivalists. They don't want to hurt anybody. They're just trying to make their money, get their food, pay their bills, supplement some income if they can't make ends meet. And that happens a lot. You know, there's a lot of marijuana dealers that do that. But then you get the kids that's the way of life. And as a way of life, territory and encroachment become real. And that causes and breeds fights and violence. It really does. So having a handle on where the real drug turf wars are. I think the police can do a little bit more in that area. Now, I can't criticize them without knowing their internal politics and practices, but I see they do stakeouts. They used to have all these different drug units, narcotics enforcement team, narcotics field unit. There were all these different units that were trying to figure out, like, what are all these units? What is the specialty in all these units? And what are we getting for that? And a lot of times we would see a lot of overtime being spent, lots of overtime. Some cops were making like their salary in overtime. We were seeing a lot of buyers come into the system without the drug dealers. And it's like, that's who we're catching. And we would see these sting operations where they would be using confidential informants to go after low-level marijuana dealers. And look, if we're going to have these units that are taking up a lot of resources, can we find a sophistication or training and technology that allows us to go after these major drug dealers? The low-level people don't have planes and cargo to bring this stuff in. Where is it coming from? The low-level people don't have planes and cargo to bring this stuff in. So where is it coming from? Can we put more resources and intel on that particular aspect? I don't know why it seems like we can't. I don't know why.
Yeah, I mean, I also don't know why. Like, you know, people in Kensington are not making fentanyl. Yeah, it's coming from somewhere.
Right, and isn't Kensington near Port Richmond? So ports, right? They're over there. What is going on? It just baffles me. And I don't think everyone's just growing this in their own backyard.
We spend almost $800 million per year on police. There are so many other services that could be provided with even a fraction of that. Philly has been piloting a non-police response to mental health crises for the past 2 years. We don't need cops to be called when people are dealing with mental health and drug-related emergencies. We need more programs like mobile crisis units so that people can call 911 and get help instead of police. We need more funding for harm reduction teams to help prevent overdose and free or low-cost addiction treatment that people can be guided towards. Akila shared how he and his team at NCST are approaching this in Newark.
We also launched a non-law enforcement response to OD because Newark has the largest population of OD folks in the state, primarily black men. We do not call the police because, you know, that fentanyl is a Schedule I drug or something like that. You will get arrested, even though there's a Good Samaritan law in place where law enforcement will not arrest if you call in and you're ODing, right? But people still don't trust that because people have relationships and stuff, you know, and they know that they're on the list to be picked up. And so if you are ODing, you're not calling the police. And so we met with our PD and with a lot of the city stakeholders around that and said, give us an opportunity to go in first. So we're forming a partnership with EMS, and we're going to have a non-law enforcement response to OD. And we're like, officers, if we need your help on the back end, we will call you. But let us get in there first and see what we can do, because there's public safety implications with that. It's not only a health implication, but, you know, people hustle and somebody sells somebody some bad stuff. You know, people party and use these drugs, right? And somebody OD at the party, you know, people will traditionally go after the folks who sold it to them. And so that takes maintenance and work. And so it's a public health and a public safety issue for us.
When opioids became legal, there was a recognition of the fact that people need drugs to manage pain. But many black and brown people are profiled as drug seeking when trying to get treatment for serious health issues. The massive expansion of both legal and illegal drug markets has led to the fact that over 20 million Americans self-identify as dealing with addiction. In 2018, only 11% of these people were able to receive treatment. And the grand majority of doctors and psychiatrists are not certified to treat addiction or practice pain management. In 2021, over 1,200 people died from overdose in Philadelphia, more than any other year on record. And in the US and Canada, more than 600,000 people have died since 1999. Experts have warned that unless we make immediate and drastic changes, over a million more will die from overdose in this decade alone. Over the next 18 years, Philadelphia should receive $200 million from a national settlement with drug companies. Some of that money is already slated to fund community programs, but there's still the question of where the rest of it will go. District Attorney Larry Krasner talked about what's possible
when we look at drug use not as a criminal issue, but as a public health problem that requires humane, holistic systems to solve.
We should look at the most successful drug treatment program in the history of the world, which is the one that they have had starting in Lisbon, but throughout Portugal for almost 20 years. This is a program started by a doctor in which you keep lawyers, judges, criminal courts, and police officers away, and you handle it without any kind of criminal proceeding where the offense is possession of drugs. It's a system that is way, 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 way more successful at reducing the level of drug use than what we have in the United States. More specifically, they've had an 80% reduction in on-street opioid use in Lisbon over the last 20 years by doing exactly the opposite of what we do, by decriminalizing it and dealing with it for what it is, which is a public health problem addressing a disease, and that disease is substance abuse disorder. So, you know, I say all this to say that there are bright examples. There are directions we can go. There are important, intelligent things we can do. Certain things we may not be able to overcome completely. I don't know how we can ever overcome the obscenity of having so many guns available in our society. But I do think we could overcome the easy availability of opioid pills. The United States consumes 75% of the world's supply of opioid pills. And guess what we have? We will have a record in Philadelphia this year for the most fatal overdose deaths, and they will overwhelmingly be associated with a bunch of opioid pills that many, many, many other countries, including some of the countries I already mentioned, won't even let across the border because they understand how damaging it is. So there are shiny examples out there of things that we can try to do. There's some other things we'll never be able to replicate. We're not at national health insurance yet. I wish we were. It would make a tremendous difference for people who are dealing with addiction and living on the street as a result of it. But we can go in that direction. And hopefully, we can get there eventually.
Instead of trying to figure out which drug users deserve help and which we should feel sympathy for, we should treat them all with dignity and care. We may never know why one person can use drugs recreationally without great disruption to their daily lives, while others become more consumed. What's clear is that the toll is not just on that individual, but also on their community and their loved ones, especially their children.
These young kids that are coming now is worse. I tell them, where your parents at? You know, they say their parents are drug addicts. They don't have nobody out there. Because of the drugs and the addictions of parents having, like, the kids just run rampant now. So where do you think they're going to look for that acceptance? The same place I did when I was young, with the hustlers, the thugs, and drug dealers from the neighborhood. That's where they're going to find the acceptance. And to fit in by any means, they're going to do what needs to be done. If them old heads tell them what to do, they're going to do it. There's no more rec centers. You rarely see rec centers now. They can just pay for the equipment that these kids need to play sports and stay out of trouble. You know, to learn teamwork, to rely on your teammate and stuff like that. Something to give them positive morale, values, morals. You can't get that from a family or parents that's dysfunctional or addicts. Like, I'm quite sure a lot of y'all heard the story of my mother, who was an addict. But I had my grandmother who raised me. She left me with my grandmother because she knew my grandmother would raise me right.
How, if at all, do you think your mom's addiction, how do you think that changed what you thought of the world and what you could do, what you should do?
Having a mother that's addiction is hard. Not being happy, your mother, which takes a toll. Excuse me. No, but see, some people don't understand. Like, I tell people, my incarceration is a blessing and a curse.
What do you mean by that?
Because also, although I'm incarcerated, and I'm not with my loved ones, my family. My mother's clean because of me being here. So I'm fine with that. It gave my mother, you know, a drive, motivation. Because at the beginning, like, I spoke to her about it when I knew when I was on trial, and I knew I was about to get sentenced. I knew it was going to be a bad outcome. So I told my mother, I'm like, listen, I have a child, your grandchild. I'm not going to be able to be there. I don't need her to be going through the same things I went through. So she gave me her word that she would get clean, and I wouldn't have nothing to worry about. And to this day, Mom kept that word. That means the world to me. She probably wouldn't agree with what I'm about to say, but if me being here is what gets her clean, then I'll gladly be here for her. I wouldn't change it. If it meant me not coming here and her still being an addict, I'm not cool with that at all. I'd rather her be clean than me be in the situation that I'm in now, because at least I had my mother. Like, I wouldn't have been able to deal with the time that I deal with now had my mom been on drugs, worrying about what can happen to her, whether she OD, whether she get killed from trying to, you know, rob somebody drugs hash or something, you know what I mean? So I know with these kids out there now, the parents that are drug addicts, they might not be fortunate enough like I was to have a grandmother that wasn't about that lifestyle, that could take care of them, you know what I mean? Provide for them as much as they could. So all they have out there is outside, you know, the streets.
What did that mean to you, that she got clean?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's a blessing. It's a blessing. My mom been my rock since day one. Like, I would be totally lost in this situation without her. Everything she does, like, she goes to rallies. Whenever she's in magazines, newspaper articles, pictures, I make sure I collect all that stuff.
And why do you collect it?
Because I'm proud of her.
This past November of 2022, 9 people were shot in Kensington in one night. Residents and people working to improve things in the neighborhood have asked for more city and state support to deal with such a profound crisis of public health and safety. The struggles of Kensington are deeply rooted and complex, and a lot of people don't trust the cops to help with addiction, gun violence, or poverty in the areas of Philadelphia where the drug economy is most active. And former Attorney General, now Governor, Josh Shapiro, has questioned if the decades of police response has actually improved the quality of life for the people of Kensington. The opioid crisis isn't going away, in Philadelphia or elsewhere. Safe injection sites, where people can use drugs under medical supervision, were set to open in Philadelphia, but a long legal battle has kept any from opening here. Some mistakenly believe that safe injection sites promote drug use, when their goal is really to keep people from fatally overdosing. As much as neighbors don't like seeing people openly inject drugs in Kensington, some also opposed a safe injection site. We don't know what will reduce the number of people using drugs, but maybe that isn't the question. What will improve the quality of life for people in places where drug economies are active? And how can we keep people safer? New York has 2 safe injection sites and has reversed hundreds of overdoses since 2021 without any deaths. In our next episode, we'll continue the conversation and talk more deeply about police and prosecution. What are these systems actually doing to respond to gun violence and homicide? And what, if anything, is working? Thanks for joining us for this episode of Move It Forward. If you enjoyed it, please take a minute to subscribe to the show. This podcast was produced in collaboration with Kyla Van Buren, the rest of the crew at Amistad Law Project, and myself, Chris Henderson. Special thanks to Miguel Leon and all the interns who helped make this season possible, especially Tui Ho and the students in Thomas Dichter's prison abolition class at Harvard University. To follow more of Amistad's work, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, or visit us at amistadlaw.org.